witnessed a nation. Pendergast turned some pages. Also, they've now run salivase enzyme tests on brain sections from the older boy and from Jolly. And? Both brains tested positive for the presence of saliva.
Jesus. You mean the killer's eating the fucking brain?
Not only eating, Lieutenant, but slobbering over the food as well. Clearly he, she, or it has no manners. You have the SOC report, may I see it? DeGusta handed it over.
You won't find any surprises there. The blood on the painting was Jolly's. They found traces of blood leading past the secure area and down into a stairwell to the sub-basement. But last night's rain flushed all traces out of there, of course.
Pendergast scanned the document. And here's the report on the door to the vault. Someone did quite a lot of pounding and banging, possibly with a blunt instrument. There were also three-pronged scratches consistent with those found on the victims. Once again, the force used was considerable.
Pendergast handed over the files.
It sounds as if we'll need to devote more attention to the sub-basement. Basically, Vincent, this DNA business is our best chance for now. If we can trace the origin of that claw fragment, we'll have our first solid lead. That's why I've asked for this meeting.
The car pulled up in front of a warren of ivy-covered red brick buildings overlooking the East River. A guard ushered them into a side entrance. Once inside the lab, Pendergast took up a position against a table in the center of the room and chatted with the scientists, Buchholz and Thoreau. DeGusta admired how easily the Southerner could take charge of a scene.
My colleague and I would like to understand the DNA sequencing process, Pendergast was saying. We need to know how you arrived at these results and whether any further analysis might be called for. I'm sure you understand.
Certainly, said Buchholz. He was busy and small, and as bald as Mount Monadnock. My assistant, Dr. Thoreau here, did the analysis.
Thoreau stepped forward nervously.
When we were given the sample, he said, we were asked to identify whether it had come from a large carnivorous mammal, specifically a big cat. What we do in such a case is compare the DNA in the sample to the DNA of, say, 5 or 6 species that are likely matches. But we would also select an animal that was definitely not of the sample, and we call this the outgroup. It's a kind of control. Am I making sense?
So far, said Pendergast. But go easy on me. I'm a child in these matters.
We usually use human DNA as the outgroup, since we've mapped so much of it. Anyway, we do a PCR, that is, a polymerase chain reaction, on the sample. This causes thousands and thousands of copies of the genes to be made. It gives us a lot to work with, you see.
He pointed to a large machine with long, clear strips of plexiglass attached to its flanks. Behind the strips were dark vertical bands arrayed in complicated patterns.
This is a pulsed field gel electrophoresis machine. We place the sample in here, and portions of the sample migrate out along these strips through the gel according to their molecular weights. They show up as these dark bands. By the pattern of bands, and with the aid of our computer, we can figure out what genes are present.
He took a deep breath.
Anyway, we got a negative reading on the big cat genes. A very negative reading. It wasn't anywhere close. And to our surprise, we got a positive reading on the outgroup, that is, Homo sapiens. And as you know, we identified DNA strands from several species of gecko, or so it appears.
He looked a little sheepish.
But even so, most of the genes in the sample were unidentified.
So that's why you presumed it was contaminated.
Yes, contaminated or degraded. A lot of repeated base pairs in the sample suggested a high level of genetic damage.
Genetic damage? Asked Pendergast.
When DNA is damaged or defective, it often uncontrollably replicates long repeating sequences of the same base pair. Viruses can damage DNA, so can radiation, certain chemicals, even cancer.
Pendergast had begun to roam around the laboratory, examining his surroundings with an almost cat-like curiosity.
These gecko genes interest me a great deal. Just what do they mean, exactly?
That's the big mystery, said Thoreau. These are rare genes. Some genes are very common, like the cytochrome B gene, which can be found in everything from a periwinkle to a man, But these gecko genes, well, we don't know anything about them.
What you're really saying is the DNA didn't come from an animal, right?
DeGusta asked.
Not from any large carnivorous mammal we know of, Buchholz answered. We tested all the relevant taxa. There are not nearly enough matches to say it came from a gecko. So, by a process of elimination, I would say it probably came from a human. But it was degraded or contaminated. The results are ambiguous.
The sample, said DeGusta, was found in the body of a murdered boy.
Ah, said Thoreau. That could easily explain how it was contaminated with human genetic material. Really, it would be much easier for us if we knew things like this beforehand.
Pendergast frowned. The sample was removed from the root canal of a claw by the forensic pathologist, as I understand it, and every effort was made to prevent contamination.
All it can take is one cell, said Thoreau. A claw, you say?
He thought a moment.
Let me advance an idea. The claw might be from a lizard that was heavily contaminated by blood from its human victim. Any lizard, not necessarily a gecko. He looked at Buchholz. The only reason we identified some of the DNA as gecko is because a fellow in Baton Rouge did some research a few years ago on gecko genetics and logged his results in GenLab. Otherwise, it would have turned up unknown, like most of that sample.
Pendergast looked at Thoreau. I'd like further tests done to tell us just what those gecko genes do, if you don't mind.
Thoreau frowned. Mr. Pendergast, the chance of a successful analysis is not all that high, and it could take weeks. It seems to me the mystery's already been solved.
Buchholz clapped his hand on Thoreau's back.
Let's not second-guess Agent Pendergast. After all, the police are paying for it, and it is a very expensive procedure.
Pendergast smiled more broadly.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Dr. Buchholz. Just send the bill to Director of Special Operations, FBI.
He wrote down the address on his business card. And please don't worry. Cost is no consideration whatsoever. DeGusta had to grin. He knew what Pendergast was doing. Getting even for the lousy car. He shook his head.
What a devil.
24. Thursday. At 11:15 Thursday morning, a man claiming to be the living incarnation of the Egyptian pharaoh Thoth ran amok in the antiquities wing, knocking over two displays in the temple of Azarnar, breaking a case and pulling a mummy out of its tomb. Three policemen were necessary to restrain him, and several curators worked the rest of the day replacing bandages and collecting ancient dust. Less than an hour later, a woman ran screaming from the Hall of Great Apes, babbling about something she'd seen crouched in a dark bathroom corner. A television team, waiting on the south steps for a glimpse of Wright, got her entire hysterical exit on film. Around lunchtime, a group calling itself the Alliance Against Racism had begun picketing outside the museum, calling for a boycott of the Superstition exhibition. Early that afternoon, Anthony McFarlane, a world-renowned philanthropist and big game hunter, offered a reward of $500,000 for the capture and safe delivery of the museum beast. The museum immediately disclaimed any connection with McFarlane. All of these events were duly reported in the press. The following incidents, however, went undisclosed to the world outside the museum. By noon, four employees had quit without notice. 35 others had taken unscheduled vacations. Nearly 300 had called in sick. Shortly after lunch, a junior preparator in the vertebrate paleontology department collapsed at her laboratory table. She was taken to medical, where she demanded extended leave and workers' compensation, citing severe emotional and physical stress. By 3 p.m., security had responded to 7 requests for investigations of suspicious noises in various remote sections of the museum. By curfew, police from the museum command post had responded to 4 suspected sightings, all of which remained unverified. Later, the museum switchboard would tabulate the number of creature-related calls it received that day, 107, including crank messages, bomb threats, and offers of assistance from exterminators to spiritualists. 25. Smithback eased open the grimy door and peered inside. This, he thought, had to be one of the more macabre places in the museum. The storage area of the physical anthropology laboratory, or in museum parlance, the skeleton room. The museum had one of the largest collections of skeletons in the country, second only to the Smithsonian. 12,000 in this room alone. Most were North and South American Indian or African, collected in the 19th century during the heyday of physical anthropology. Tiers of large metal drawers rose in ordered ranks to the ceiling. Each drawer contained at least a portion of a human skeleton. Yellowed labels were slotted into the front of each drawer. On these labels were numbers, names of tribes, sometimes a short history. Other, briefer labels carried the chill of anonymity. Smithback had once spent an afternoon wandering among the boxes, opening them and reading the notes, almost all of which were written in faded, elegant scripts. He had jotted several down in his notebook. Specimen number 1880, 1770. Walks in cloud. Yankton Sioux. Killed in Battle of Medicine Bow Creek, 1880. Specimen number 1899, 1206. Maggie Lost Horse, Northern Cheyenne. Specimen number 1933, 43469. Anasazi, Canyon del Muerto, Thorpe Carlson Expedition, 1900. Specimen number 1912, 695. Luo, Lake Victoria, Gift of Major General Henry Throckmorton, Bart. Specimen number 1872, 10, Aleut, provenance unknown. It was a strange graveyard indeed. Beyond the storage area lay the warren of rooms housing the physical anthropology lab. In earlier days, physical anthropologists had spent most of their time in this laboratory measuring bones and trying to determine the relationship between the races, where humanity had originated, and similar studies. Now, much more complex biochemical and epidemiological research was being done in the physical anthro lab. Several years earlier, the museum, at Frock's insistence, had decided to merge its genetics research and DNA laboratories with the lab. Beyond the dusty bone storage area lay a spotless assortment of huge centrifuges, hissing autoclaves, electrophoresis apparatuses, glowing monitors, elaborate blown glass distillation columns, and titration setups, one of the most advanced technical facilities of its kind. It was in the no man's land between the old and the new that Greg Kawakita had set up shop. Smithback looked through the tall racks of the storage room toward the lab doors. It was just after 10, and Kawakita was the only one around. Through the open shelves, Smithback could see Kawakita standing one or two rows over, making sharp, jerky, overhead movements with his left hand, waving something about. Then Smithback heard the zing of a line and the whirring of a fly reel. Well, raise my rent, Smithback thought. The man was fishing. Catch anything? He called out loudly. He heard a sharp exclamation and a clatter of a dropped rod. Damn you, Smithback, Kawakita said. You're always sneaking about. This isn't a good time to go around scaring people, you know. I might have been packing a 45 or something. He walked down his aisle and came around the corner, reeling in his fly rod and scowling good-humoredly at Smithback. Smithback laughed. I told you not to work down here with all these skeletons. Now look what's happened. You've gone off the deep end at last. Just practicing, Kawakita laughed. Watch. Third shelf, buffalo hump. He flicked the rod. The line whirred out, and the fly struck, then rebounded off a drawer on the third tier of a shelf at the end of the aisle. Smithback walked over. Sure enough, it contained the bones of someone who had once been Buffalo Hump. Smithback whistled. Kawakita drew in some line, loosely holding the loops in his left hand while he gripped the cork butt of the rod in his right. Fifth shelf, second row. John Mboya, he said. Again, the line arced through the air between the narrow shelves, and the tiny fly ticked the correct label. Isaac Walton, move over, said Smithback, shaking his head. Kawakita reeled in the line and started dismantling the bamboo rod. It's not quite like fishing on a river, he said as he worked.
but it's great practice, especially in this confined space. Helps me relax during breaks. When I don't tangle my line in one of the cases, that is.
When Kawakita was first hired by the museum, he had declined the sunny fifth-floor office offered him, and instead claimed a much smaller one in the lab, saying he wanted to be closer to the action. Since then, he had already published more papers than some full curators had in their entire careers. His cross-disciplinary studies under Frock had quickly led him to an assistant curatorship in evolutionary biology, where he had initially devoted his time to the study of plant evolution. Kawakita skillfully used his mentor's notoriety to advance himself. Lately, he had put aside plant evolution temporarily for the genetic sequence extrapolator program. His only other passion in life, aside from his work, seemed to be fly fishing. In particular, as he would explain to anyone who listened, his search for the noble and elusive Atlantic salmon. Kawakita slid the rod into a battered Orvis case and leaned it carefully in a corner. Motioning Smith back to follow, he led the way down long rows of coffined aisles to a large desk and three heavy wooden chairs. The desk, Smithback noticed, was covered with papers, stacks of well-thumbed monographs, and low trays of plastic-covered sand holding various human bones.
"Look at this," Kawakita said, sliding something in Smithback's direction.
It was an engraved illustration of a family tree, etched in brown ink on hand-marbled paper. The branches of the tree were labeled with various Latin words.
"Nice," said Smithback, taking a seat. "That's one word for it, I guess," Kawakita replied. "A mid-19th century view of human evolution. An artistic masterpiece, but a scientific travesty. I'm working on a little piece for the Human Evolution Quarterly about early evolutionary views."
"When will it be published?" Smithback asked with professional interest.
"Oh, early next year. These journals are so slow."
Smithback put the chart down on the desk.
"So what does all this have to do with your current work, the GRE or the SAT or whatever it is?"
"GSE, actually," Kawakita laughed. "Nothing whatsoever. This is just a little idea I had, some after-hours fun. I still enjoy getting my hands dirty from time to time."
He replaced the chart carefully in a binder, then turned toward the writer.
"So, how's the masterwork coming along?" he asked. "Is Madame Rickman still giving you a hard time?"
Smithback laughed. "Guess my struggles under the tyrant are common knowledge by now. But that's a book in itself. Actually, I came by to talk to you about Margot."
Kawakita took a seat across from Smithback.
"Margot Green? What about her?"
Smithback started paging aimlessly through one of the monographs scattered about the work table.
"I understand she needs your help on something."
Kawakita's eyes narrowed.
"She called last night, asking if she could run some data through the extrapolation program. I told her it wasn't ready yet."
He shrugged.
"Technically, that's true. I can't vouch 100% for the accuracy of its correlations, but I'm terribly busy these days, Bill. I just don't have the time to shepherd somebody through the program."
"She's not exactly some scientific illiterate you need to lead around by the nose," Smithback replied. "She's doing some heavy-duty genetics research of her own. You must see her around this lab all the time."
He pushed the monographs aside and leaned forward.
"It might not hurt to cut the kid a break," he said. "It isn't exactly an easy time for her. Her father died about 2 weeks ago, you know."
Kawakita looked surprised.
"Really?
Is that what you were talking about in the staff lounge?"
Smithback nodded. "She hasn't said much, but it's been a struggle. She's considering leaving the museum."
"That would be a mistake," Kawakita frowned. He started to say something, then stopped abruptly. He leaned back in his chair and gave Smithback a long, appraising look.
"This is a mighty altruistic gesture on your part, Bill."
He pursed his lips, nodding slowly.
"Bill Smithback, the Good Samaritan. New image for you, eh?"
"That's William Smithback, Jr. to you."
"Bill Smithback, the Eagle Scout,"
Kawakita continued. Then he shook his head.
"Nope, it just doesn't ring true. You didn't really come down here to talk about Margot, did you?"
Smithback hesitated.
Well, that was one of my reasons, he admitted.
I knew it, Kawakita crowed.
Come on, out with it.
Oh, all right, Smithback sighed. Listen, I'm trying to get some information on the Whittlesey expedition.
The what?
The South American expedition that brought back the Mbun figure. You know, the showpiece for the new exhibition.
Recognition flooded Kawakita's face.
Oh, yes. That's the one old man Smith must have been talking about in the herbarium the other day. What about it?
Well, we think there's some kind of link between that expedition and these murders.
What? Kawakita said incredulously. Don't tell me you're starting up with this museum beast stuff. And what do you mean, we?
I'm not saying I believe anything, okay? Smithback replied evasively. But I've been hearing a lot of strange stuff recently, and Rickman's all tense about having the Mbun figure in the exhibition. Other things came back from that expedition besides this one relic. Several crates, in fact. I want to find out more about them.
And what exactly do I have to do with all this? Kawakita asked.
Nothing. But you're an assistant curator. You have high security access to the museum computer. You can query the accession database, find out about those crates.
I doubt they've even been logged, Kawakita said. But either way, it wouldn't matter.
Why not? Smithback asked.
Kawakita laughed. Wait here a minute. He stood up and headed for the lab. In a few minutes, he returned, a piece of paper in one hand.
You must be psychic, he said, handing over the paper.
Look what I found in my mail this morning. 2. Curators and senior staff. From Lavinia Rickman. Copies. Wright, Llewellyn, Cuthbert, Lafour. As a result of recent unfortunate events, the museum is under intense scrutiny by the media and by the public in general. This being the case, I want to take the opportunity to review the museum's policy on external communications. Any dealings with the press are to be handled through the museum's public relations office. No comments on museum matters are to be made, either on or off the record, to journalists or other members of the media. Any statements made or assistance given to individuals who are engaged in preparing interviews, documentaries, books, articles, etc., dealing with the museum are to be cleared through this office. Failure to follow these guidelines will result in disciplinary action from the director's office. Thank you for your cooperation in this difficult time.
Christ, muttered Smithback. Look at this. Individuals engaged in preparing books.
She means you, Bill, Kawakita laughed.
So you see, my hands are tied.
He extracted a handkerchief from his back pocket and blew his nose.
Allergic to bone dust, he explained.
I just can't believe this, Smithback said, rereading the memo.
Kawakita clapped an arm around Smithback's shoulder.
Bill, my friend, I know this story would make great copy, and I'd like to help you write the most controversial, outrageous, and salacious book possible, only I can't. I'll be honest, I've got a career here, and, he tightened his grip, I'm coming up for tenure. I can't afford to make those kinds of waves right now. You'll have to go some other route, okay?
Smithback nodded with resignation.
Okay. You look unconvinced, Kawakita laughed. But I'm glad you understand, anyway.
He gently propelled the writer to his feet.
I'll tell you what. How about a little fishing on Sunday? They're predicting an early hatch on the Kennetquot.
Smithback finally grinned.
Tie me some of your devilish little nymphs, he said. You're on.
26. The Gusta was all the way on the other side of the museum when yet another call came in. Emergency sighting, Section 18, computer room. He sighed, shoving his radio back into its holster, thinking of his tired feet.
Everyone in the damn place was seeing boogeymen.
A dozen people were crowding the hall outside the computer room, joking nervously. 2 uniformed officers were standing by the closed door.
Okay, said DeGusta, unwrapping a cigar. Who saw it?
A young man edged forward. White lab coat, slope-shouldered, Coke bottle glasses, calculator and pager dangling off the belt.
Cripes, thought DeGusta. Where did they get these guys? He was perfect.
I didn't actually see anything, he said,
but there was this loud thumping noise in the electrical systems room. It sounded like banging, someone trying to get through the door.
DeGusta turned to the two cops.
Let's check it out.
He fumbled at the doorknob, and someone produced a key, explaining, we locked it. We didn't want anything coming out. DeGusta waved his hand. This was getting ridiculous. Everyone was spooked. How the hell could they be planning a big opening party for the following night? They should have shut the damn place down after the first murders. The room was large, circular, and spotless. In the center, standing on a large pedestal and bathed in bright neon lights, was a 5-foot-tall white cylinder that DeGusta supposed was the museum's mainframe. It hummed softly, surrounded by terminals, workstations, tables, and bookcases. 2 closed doors were visible on the far walls.
You guys poke around, he told his men, popping the unlit cigar in his mouth. I want to talk to this guy, do the paperwork.
He went back outside.
Name?
He asked.
Roger Thrumcap. I'm the shift supervisor.
Okay,
DeGusta said wearily, making notations.
You're reporting noises in data processing.
No, sir. Data processing's upstairs. This is the computer room. We monitor the hardware, do systems work.
The computer room, then.
He scribbled some more.
You first noticed these noises when?
A few minutes after 10. We were just finishing up our journals.
You were reading the paper when you heard the noises?
No, sir. The journal tapes. We were just finishing our daily backup.
I see. You were just finishing at 10 o'clock.
The backups can't be done during peak hours, sir. We have special permission to come in at 6 in the morning.
Lucky you. And you heard these noises where?
They were coming from the electrical room.
And that is?
The door to the left of the MP3. That's the computer, sir.
I saw 2 doors in there, DeGusta said. What's behind the other one?
Oh, that's just the lights-out room. It's on a carded entry system. Nobody can get in there.
DeGusta gave the man a strange look.
It contains the disk packs, things like that. You know, the storage devices. It's called a lights-out room because everything's automated. Nobody goes in there except for maintenance.
He nodded proudly.
We're in a zero-operator environment. Compared to us, DP is still in the Stone Age. They still have operators manually mounting tapes, no silos or anything.
DeGusta went back inside.
They heard the noises on the other side of that door to the left, there in the back. Let's take a look.
He turned around.
Keep them out here, he said to Thrumcap.
The door to the electrical room swung open, releasing a smell of hot wiring and ozone. DeGusta fumbled along the wall, found the light, and snapped it on. He did a visual first by the book. Transformers, grill work covering ventilation ducts, cables, several large air conditioning units, a lot of hot air, but nothing else.
Take a look behind that equipment, DeGusta said.
The officers nosed around thoroughly. One looked back and shrugged.
All right, said DeGusta, walking out into the computer room. Looks clean to me, Mr. Thrumcap.
Yes?
He poked his head in.
You can tell your people to come back in. Looks okay, but we're going to post a man for the next 36 hours.
He turned to one of the policemen emerging from the electrical room.
Waters, I want you here till the end of your shift. Pro forma, all right? I'll send you relief.
A few more sightings and I'll be fresh out of officers.
Right,
said Waters.
That's a good idea, said Thrumcap. This room is the heart of the museum, you know. Or rather, the brain. We run the telephones, physical plant, network, mini-printing, electronic mail, security system.
Sure, said DeGusta.
He wondered if this was the same security that didn't have an accurate blueprint of the sub-basement. The staff began filing back into the room and taking up their places at the terminals. DeGusta mopped his brow.
Hot as balls in here.
He turned to leave.
Raj,
he heard a voice behind him.
We got a problem.
DeGusta hesitated a moment.
Oh, my God, said Thrumcap, staring at a monitor. The system's doing a hex dump. What the hell?
Was the master terminal still in backup mode when you left it, Raj?
A short guy with buck teeth was asking.
If it finished and got no response, it might have gone into a low-level dump.
Maybe you're right, said Roger. Abort the dump and make sure the regions are all up.
It's not responding.
Is the OS down? Thrumcap asked, bending over Bucktooth's CRT. Let me see this.
An alarm went off in the room, not loud, but high-pitched and insistent. DeGusta saw a red light in the ceiling panel above the sleek mainframe. Maybe he'd better stick around.
Now what?
Said Thrumcap.
Jesus, it's hot, DeGusta thought. How can these people stand it?
What's this code we're getting? I don't know. Look it up.
Where?
In the manual, fool. It's right behind your terminal. Here, I've got it.
Thrumcap started flipping pages.
2291, 2291. Here it is.
It's a heat alarm. Oh, Lord, the machine's overheating. Get maintenance up here right away.
DeGusta shrugged. The thumping noise they'd heard was probably air conditioner compressors failing.
It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. It must be 90 degrees in here.
As he began moving down the hall, he passed two maintenance men hurrying in the opposite direction. Like most modern supercomputers, the museum's Digital Industries MP3 was better able to withstand heat than the big iron mainframes of 10 or 20 years before. Its silicon brain, unlike the older vacuum tubes and transistors, could function above recommended temperatures for longer periods of time without damage or loss of data. However, the hardwired interface to the museum's security system had been installed by a third party, outside the operating specifications of Digital Industries. When the temperature in the computer room reached 94 degrees, the tolerances of the ROM chips governing the automatic disaster control system were exceeded. Failure occurred 90 seconds later. Waters stood in a corner and glanced around the room. The maintenance man had left over an hour before, and the room was pleasantly chilly. Everything was back to normal, and the only sounds were the hum of the computer and the zombies clicking thousands of keys. He idly glanced at an unoccupied terminal screen and saw a blinking message. External array failure at ROM. Address 33B14A0E.
It was like Chinese. Whatever it was, why couldn't they just say it in English? He hated computers. He couldn't think of one damn thing computers had done for him except leave the ass off his last name on bills. He hated those smart-ass computer nerds, too. If there was anything wrong here, let them take care of it.
27. Smithback dumped his notebooks beside one of his favorite library carrels. Sighing heavily, he squeezed himself into the cramped space, placed his laptop on the desk, and turned on the small overhead light. He was only a stone's throw from the oak-paneled reading room, with its red leather chairs and marble fireplace that hadn't seen use in a century. But Smithback preferred the narrow, scuffed carrels. He especially liked the ones that were hidden deep in the stacks, where he could examine documents and manuscripts he'd temporarily liberated, or catch 40 winks, in privacy and relative comfort. The museum's collection of new, old, and rare books on all aspects of natural history was unrivaled. It had received so many bequests and privately donated collections over the years that its card catalog was always hopelessly behind. Yet Smithback knew the library better even than most of the librarians. He could find a buried fact in record time. Now he pursed his lips, thinking. Moriarty was a stubborn bureaucrat, and Smithback himself had come up empty with Kawakita. He didn't know anyone else who could get him into the accession database. But there was more than one way to approach this puzzle. At the microfilm card file, he started flipping through the New York Times index. He backtracked as far as 1975. Nothing there, or, as he soon discovered, in the relevant natural history and anthropological journals. He checked the back issues of the museum's internal periodicals for information on the expedition. Nothing. In the 1985 Who's Who at NYMNH, a two-line bio of Whittlesey told him nothing he didn't already know. He cursed under his breath.
This guy's hidden deeper than the Oak Island treasure.
Smithback slowly put the volumes back on their racks, looking around. Then, taking some sheets from a notebook, he strolled nonchalantly up to the desk of a reference librarian, first making sure he hadn't seen her before.
"Gotta put these back in the archives," he told the librarian.
She blinked up at him severely. "Are you new around here?"
I'm from the science library. Just got transferred up last week. On rotation, you know.
He gave her a smile, hoped it looked bright and genuine. She frowned at him, uncertain, as the phone on her desk began to ring. She hesitated, then answered it, distractedly handing him a clipboard and a key on a long blue cord. "Sign in," she said, covering the mouthpiece with her hand. The library archives lay behind an unmarked gray door in a remote corner of the library's stacks. It was a gamble in more ways than one. Smithback had been inside once before on legitimate business. He knew that the bulk of the museum's archives were stored elsewhere and that the library's files were very specific. But something was nagging him. He closed the door and moved forward, scanning the shelves and the stacks of labeled boxes. He had progressed down one side of the room and was starting up the other when he stopped. Carefully, he reached up and brought down a box labeled Central Receiving Shipping, Air Cargo Receipts. Squatting down, he rustled quickly through the papers. Once again, he went back as far as 1975. Disappointed, he rustled through them again. Nothing. As he returned the box to its high perch, his eye caught another label. Bills of Lading, 1970 to 1990. He couldn't risk more than another 5 minutes, tops. His finger stopped near the end of the pile. "Gotcha," he whispered, pulling a smudged sheet free of the box. From his pocket, he extracted his microcassette recorder and quietly spoke the pertinent words, dates, and places. Belém, Port of New Orleans, Brooklyn. The Strella de Venezuela, Star of Venezuela. Odd, he thought. Awfully long layover in New Orleans.
"You seem pretty pleased with yourself," the librarian said as she stowed the key back in the desk.
"Have a nice day," Smithback said. He finished the entry on the archives clipboard. Sebastian Melmoth, in 1110, out 1125. Back at the microfilm catalog, Smithback paused. He knew the New Orleans newspaper had a strange name, very antebellum-sounding.
Times-Picayune, that was it.
He scanned the catalog quickly. There it was. Times-Picayune, 1840 to present. He snapped the 1988 reel into the machine. As he neared October, he slowed, then stopped completely. A large 72-point banner headline stared at him out of the microfilm viewer.
"Oh, God," he breathed.
He now knew, without a shred of doubt, why the Whittlesea crates had spent so long in New Orleans. 28.
"I'm sorry, Miss Green, but his door is still closed. I'll give him your message as soon as possible."
"Thanks," Margot said, hanging up her phone with frustration. How could she be Frock's eyes and ears if she couldn't even talk to him? When Frock was deeply involved in a project, he often locked himself in his office. His secretary knew better than to disturb him. Margot had tried to reach him twice already that morning, and there was no telling when he'd reemerge. Margot glanced at her watch. 11:20 a.m. The morning was almost gone. She turned to her terminal and tried logging on to the museum's computer. "Hello, Margot Green at biotech at STF. Welcome back to MuseNet. Distributed networking system, release 15.5. Copyright 1989 to 1995, NYMNH and Cerebral Systems, Inc. Connecting at 11:20:45, 3:30:95. Print service routed to LJ56. All users, important notice. Due to this morning's system outage, a restore will be performed at noon. Expect degraded performance. Report any missing or corrupted files to Systems Administrator, ASAP. Roger Thrumcap at admin at systems. You have one message waiting." She brought up the electronic mail menu and read the waiting message. "Mail from George Moriarty at exhib at STF. Sent 10/14/7, 3:30:95. Thanks for the label copy. Looks perfect. No changes necessary. We'll put it in with other finishing touches before opening to the general public. Care to have lunch today? George. Reply, delete, file, RDF. Her telephone rang, shattering the silence. Hello, she said.
Margot, hi, it's George,
came Moriarty's voice. Hi, she replied. Sorry, just got your message now.
I figured as much,
he responded cheerfully.
Thanks again for helping out.
Glad to, replied Margot. Moriarty paused.
So,
he began hesitantly.
How about that lunch?
Sorry, Margot said. I'd like to, but I'm waiting for a call back from Dr. Frock. Could be 5 minutes, could be next week. She could tell by the silence that Moriarty was disappointed. Tell you what, though, she said. You could swing by for me on your way to the cafeteria. If Frock's called by then, maybe I'll be free. If he hasn't, well, perhaps you could hang out for a couple of minutes while I wait. Help me with the Times crossword or something.
Sure,
Moriarty replied.
I know every three-letter Australian mammal there is.
Margot hesitated. And perhaps while you're down here, we can take a peek into the accession database, see about the Whittlesea crates? There was a silence. Finally, Moriarty sighed.
Well, if it's that important to you, I guess it couldn't hurt anything. I'll stop by around 12.
Half an hour later, a knock sounded. Come in, she called out.
The damn thing's locked.
The voice was not Moriarty's. She opened the door. I didn't expect to see you here.
Do you suppose it's luck or fate?
Smithback said, coming in quickly and shutting the door behind him.
Listen, Lotus Blossom, I've been a busy man since last night.
So have I, she said. Moriarty will be here any minute to get us into the accession database. Smithback opened his mouth.
How did you...
Never mind, Margot replied smugly. The door opened and Moriarty peered in.
Margot?
He asked. Then he caught sight of Smithback.
Don't fret, Professor, it's safe, the writer said. I'm not in a biting mood today.
Don't mind him, Margot said. He has this annoying habit of popping up unannounced. Come on in.
Yes, and make yourself comfortable,
Smithback said, pointedly gesturing to the chair in front of Margot's terminal. Moriarty sat down slowly, looking at Smithback, then at Margot, then at Smithback again. I guess you want me to check the accession records, he said. If you wouldn't mind, Margot said quietly. Smithback's presence made the whole thing seem like a setup. Okay, Margot. Moriarty put his fingers on the keyboard. Smithback, turn around. The password, you know. The museum's accession database contained information on all the millions of cataloged items in the museum's collections. Initially, the database had been accessible to all employees. However, someone on the fifth floor had gotten nervous at having the artifacts' detailed descriptions and storage locations available to anyone. Now, access was limited to senior staff, assistant curators such as Moriarty and above. Moriarty was sullenly tapping keys. I could be given a reprimand for this, you know, he said. Dr. Cuthbert's very strict. Why didn't you just get Frock to do it for you?
Like I said, I can't get in to see him, Margot replied.
Moriarty gave the enter key a final jab.
Here it is, he said. Take a quick look. I'm not going to bring it up again.
Margot and Smithback crowded around the terminal as the green letters crawled slowly up the screen. Accession file number 1989-2006. Date, April 4, 1989. Collector, Julian Whittlesea, Edward Maxwell, et al. Cataloger, Hugo C. Montague. Source, Whittlesea Maxwell Amazon Basin Expedition. Location, Building 2, Level 3, Section 6, Vault 144. Note, the following cataloged items were received on February 1, 1988, in 7 crates sent back by the Whittlesea Maxwell expedition from the upper Jingku River system. 6 of the crates were packaged by Maxwell, 1 by Whittlesea. Whittlesea and Thomas R. Crocker, Jr. did not return from the expedition and are presumed dead. Maxwell and the rest of the party perished in a plane crash en route to the United States. Only Whittlesey's crate has been partially catalogued here. This note will be superseded as this crate and the Maxwell crates are fully catalogued. Descriptions are taken from journal wherever possible. HCM 489.
Did you see that? Smithbeck said. I wonder why the cataloging was never finished.
Shh, Marco hissed. I'm trying to get all this.
Number 1989-2006.1. Blowgun and dart. No data. Status C. Number 1989-2006.2. Personal Journal of J. Whittlesey, July 22, 1987 to September 17, 1987. Status TR. Number 1989-2006.3. Two grass bundles tied with parrot feathers, used as shaman's fetish from deserted hut. Status C. Number 1989-2006.4. Finely carved figurine of beast, supposed representation of Mbun. CF Whittlesey Journal, pages 56 to 59. Status OE. Number 1989-2006.5. Wooden plant press, origin unknown, from vicinity of deserted hut. Status C. Number 1989-2006.6. Disc incised with designs. Status C. Number 1989-2006.7. Spear points, assorted sizes and condition. Status C. Note. All crates temporarily moved to secure vault level 2B per Ian Cuthbert 3-2095. D. Alvarez, Secretary.
What do all those codes mean? Smithback asked.
They tell the current status of the artifact, Moriarty said. C means it's still crated up, hasn't been curated yet. OE means on exhibit. TR means temporarily removed. There are others.
Temporarily removed? Margot asked.
That's all you need to put down? No wonder the journal got lost.
Of course that's not all, Moriarty said. Whoever removes an object has to sign it out. The database is hierarchical. We can see more detail on any entry just by stepping down a level. Here, I'll show you.
He tapped a few keys. His expression changed.
That's odd.
The message on the screen read, "Invalid record or relation process halted." Moriarty frowned. There's nothing attached to this record for the Whittlesey Journal. He cleared the screen and started typing again. Nothing wrong with the others. See? Here's the detail record for the figurine. Margot examined the screen.
So what does that mean?
We know the journal's lost, Margot said.
Even if it's lost, there should still be a detail record for it, Moriarty said.
Is there a restricted flag on the record?
Moriarty shook his head and hit a few more keys.
Here's why, he said at length, pointing at the screen. The detail record's been erased.
You mean the information about the journal's location has been deleted? Smithback asked. Can they do that?
Moriarty shrugged.
It takes a high security ID.
More importantly, why should somebody do that? Margot asked. Did the mainframe problem this morning have anything to do with it?
No, Moriarty said. This file compare dump I've just done implies that the file was deleted sometime before last night's backup. I can't be more specific than that.
Deleted, huh? Smithback said. Gone forever. How clean, how neat, how coincidental. I'm beginning to see a pattern here. A nasty one.
Moriarty switched off the terminal and pushed himself back from the desk. I'm not interested in your conspiracy theories, he said.
Could it have been an accident or a malfunction? Margot asked.
Doubtful. The database has all sorts of referential integrity checks built in. I'd see an error message.
So what then? Smithback pressed.
I haven't a clue, Moriarty shrugged.
But it's a trivial issue at best.
Is that the best you can do? Smithback snorted. Some computer genius.
Moriarty, offended, pushed his glasses up his nose and stood up. "I really don't need this," he said. "I think I'll get some lunch." He headed for the door. "Margot, I'll take a rain check on that crossword puzzle."
"Nice going," Margot said as the door closed. "You've got a really subtle touch, you know that, Smithback? George was good enough to get us into the database."
"Yeah, and what did we learn from it?" Smithback asked. "Diddly squat. Only one of the crates was ever accessioned. Whittlesey's journal is still missing." He looked at her smugly. "I, on the other hand, have struck oil."
"Put it in your book," Margot yawned. "I'll read it then, assuming I can find a copy in the library."
"Et tu, Brute?" Smithback grinned and handed her a folded sheet of paper. "Well, take a look at this."
The sheet was a photocopy reproduction of an article from the New Orleans Times-Picayune dated October 17, 1987. "Ghost Freighter Found Beached Near New Orleans" by Anthony Anastasia, special to the Times-Picayune. Bayou Grove, October 16th, AP. "A small freighter bound for New Orleans ran aground last night near this small coastal town. Details remain sketchy, but preliminary reports indicate that all crew members had been brutally slain while at sea. The Coast Guard first reported the grounding at 11:45 Monday night. The ship, the Strella de Venezuela, was an 18,000-ton freighter, currently of Haitian registry, that plied the waters of the Caribbean and the main trade routes between South America and the United States. Damage was limited, and the vessel's cargo appeared to be intact. It is not presently known how the crew members met their deaths, or whether any of the crew were able to escape the ship. Henry LaPlage, a private helicopter pilot who observed the beached vessel, reported that corpses were strewn across the foredeck like some wild animal had gotten at them. I seen one guy hanging out a bridge porthole, his head all smashed up. It was like a slaughterhouse. Ain't never seen nothing like it. Local and federal authorities are cooperating in an attempt to understand the slayings, easily one of the most brutal massacres in recent maritime history. We are currently looking into several theories, but we've come to no conclusions as of yet," said Nick Lee, a police spokesman. Although there was no official comment, federal sources said that mutiny, vengeance killings by rival Caribbean shippers, and sea piracy were all being considered as possible motives. "Jesus," Margot breathed. "The wounds described here
sound just like those on the three bodies found here this week," Smithback nodded grimly.
Margot frowned. "This happened more than 6 years ago. It has to be coincidental."
"Does it?" Smithback asked. "I might be forced to agree with you if it wasn't for the fact that the Whittlesey crates were on board that ship."
"What?"
"It's true. I tracked down the bills of lading. The crates were shipped from Brazil in August of 1988, almost a year after the expedition broke up, as I understand it. After this business in New Orleans, the crates sat in customs while the investigation was being conducted. It took them almost a year and a half to reach the museum."
"The ritualized murders have followed the crates all the way from the Amazon," Margot said. "But that means..."
"It means," Smithback said grimly, "that I'm going to stop laughing now when I hear talk about a curse on that expedition. And it means you should keep locking this door."
The phone rang, startling them both.
"Margot, my dear,"
Frock's voice rumbled to her.
"What news?"
"Dr. Frock, I wonder if I could come by your office for a few minutes, at your earliest convenience."
"Splendid. Give me a little time to shuffle some of this paper off my desk and into the wastebasket. Shall we say 1 o'clock?
"Thank you," Margot said. "Smithback," she said, turning around, "we've got to..."
But the writer was gone.
At 1:50, another knock sounded. "Who's there?" Margot said through the locked door.
"It's me, Moriarty. Can I come in, Margot?"
"I just wanted to apologize for walking out earlier," Moriarty said, declining a chair. "It's just that Bill wears on me sometimes. He never seems to let up." "George, I'm the one who should apologize," Margot said. "I didn't know he was going to appear like that."
She thought of telling him about the newspaper article, but decided against it and began to pack up her carry-all. "There's something else I wanted to tell you," Moriarty went on. "While I was eating lunch, I realized that there may be some way we can find out more about that deleted database record after all, the one for Whittlesey's journal." Margot abruptly put down the carry-all and looked at Moriarty, who took a seat in front of her terminal. "Did you see that sign-on message when you logged into the network earlier?" he asked.
"The one about the computer going down?
Big surprise. I got locked out twice this morning." Moriarty nodded. The message also said they were going to restore from the backup tapes at noon. A full restore takes about 30 minutes. That means they should be done by now.
So?
Well, a backup tape holds about 2 to 3 months' worth of archives. If the detail record for the Whittlesey Journal was deleted in the last 2 months, and if the backup tape is still on the hub down in data processing, I should be able to resurrect it.
Really?
Moriarty nodded.
Then do it, Margot urged.
There's a certain element of risk, Moriarty replied. If a system operator notices that the tape is being accessed, well, he could trace it to your terminal ID.
I'll risk it, Margot said. George, she added, I know you feel this is all a wild goose chase, and I can't really blame you for that, but I'm convinced those crates from the Whittlesey expedition are connected to these killings. I don't know what the connection is, but maybe the journal could have told us something. And I don't know what we're dealing with. A serial killer? Some animal? Some creature? And not knowing scares me.
She gently took Moriarty's hand and gave it a squeeze.
But maybe we're in a position here to be of some help. We have to try.
When she noticed Moriarty blushing, she withdrew her hand. Smiling shyly, Moriarty moved to the keyboard. Here goes, he said. Margot paced the room as Moriarty worked.
Any luck?
She asked finally, moving closer to the terminal. Don't know yet, said Moriarty, squinting at the screen and typing commands. I've got the tape, but the protocol's messed up or something. The CRC checks are failing. We may get garbled data if we get anything. I'm going in the back door, so to speak, hoping to avoid attention. The seek rate is really slow this way. Then the key tap stopped. Margot, Moriarty said quietly. I've got it. The screen filled. Hell, Moriarty exclaimed. I was afraid of that. It's been partially overwritten, corrupted. See that? It just trails off into garbage.
Yes, but look,
Margot said excitedly. Moriarty examined the screen. The journal was removed by Mrs. Rickman 2 weeks ago, with Dr. Cuthbert's permission. No return date. Margot snorted.
Cuthbert said the journal had been lost.
So why was this record deleted, and by whom? Suddenly his eyes widened. Oh, Lord, I have to release my lock on the tape before somebody notices us. His fingers danced over the keys.
George, Margot said, do you know what this means? They took the journal out of the crates before the killing started, around the time Cuthbert had the crates put in the secure area. Now they're concealing evidence from the police. Why?
Moriarty frowned. You're starting to sound like Smith back, he said. There could be 1,000 explanations.
Name one, Margot challenged.
The most obvious would be that somebody else deleted the detail record before Rickman could add a lost artifact notation. Margot shook her head.
I don't believe it. There are just too many coincidences.
Margot, Moriarty began. Then he sighed. Listen, he went on patiently, this is a trying time for all of us, you especially. I know you're trying to make a tough decision, and then with a crisis like this, well,
these murders weren't committed by some garden variety maniac, Margot interrupted impatiently. I'm not crazy.
I'm not saying that, Moriarty continued. I just think you ought to let the police handle this. It's a very, very dangerous business. And you should be concentrating on your own life right now. Digging into this won't help you make up your mind about your own future. He swallowed. And it won't bring your father back.
Is that what you think? Margot blazed. You don't...
She broke off abruptly as her eye fell on the wall clock.
Jesus, I'm late for my meeting with Dr. Frock.
She grabbed her carryall and headed for the door. Halfway into the hall, she turned around.
I'll speak to you later, she said.
The door slammed. God, Moriarty thought, sitting at the darkened terminal and resting his chin in his hands. If a graduate student in plant genetics actually thinks Mbun might be loose, if even Margot Green starts seeing conspiracies behind every door, what about the rest of the museum? 29. Margot watched Frock spill his sherry down his shirt front.
Blast,
he said, dabbing with plump hands. He set the glass down on the desk with exaggerated care and looked up at Margot.
Thank you for coming to me, my dear. It's an extraordinary discovery. I'd say we should go down there this moment and take another look at that figurine, but that Pendergast fellow will be here shortly to make a further nuisance of himself.
Bless you, Agent Pendergast, Margot thought. The last thing she felt like doing was going back down into the exhibition. Frock sighed.
No matter. We'll know soon enough. Once Pendergast leaves, we'll learn the truth. This Mbun figurine could be the additional proof I've been searching for. If, that is, you are correct about the claws matching the lacerations in the victim.
But how could such a creature be loose in the museum? Margot asked.
Ah, Frock exclaimed, eyes shining. That's the question, is it not? And let me answer a question with a question. What thing, my dear Margot, is Rugos?
I don't know, Margot said. I'm not sure I even know the meaning of the word. Bumpy?
Rugos. It's a regular pattern of ridges, wrinkles, or creases. I'll tell you what's Rugos. Reptilian eggs are Rugos, as are dinosaur eggs.
A sudden current passed through Margot as she remembered.
That's the word
that Cuthbert used to describe the seed pods missing from the crate, Frock finished her sentence. I ask you, were they really seed pods? What kind of seed pod would look wrinkled and scaly? But an egg?
Frock drew himself up in his wheelchair.
Next question. Where have they gone? Were they stolen, or did something else happen to them?
Abruptly, the scientist stopped, sinking back into his wheelchair, shaking his head.
But if something hatched, something broke out of the crates, Margot said. How does that explain the killings on board the freighter that carried the crates from South America?
Margot, Frock said, laughing quietly. What we have here is a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. It is essential that we gather more facts without wasting additional time.
There was a soft rapping at the door.
That must be Pendergast, Frock said, drawing back, then louder. Come in, please.
The agent walked in, carrying a briefcase, his black suit, as ever, impeccable, his blonde white hair brushed back from his face. To Margot, he looked as collected and placid as before. When Frock gestured to one of the Victorian chairs, Pendergast seated himself.
A pleasure to see you again, sir, Frock said. You've met Miss Green. We were once again in the middle of something just now, so I hope you won't mind if she remains.
Pendergast waved his hand.
Of course. I know you'll both continue to respect my request for confidentiality.
Of course, said Frock.
Dr. Frock, I know you're busy and I'll keep this short, Pendergast began. I was hoping you'd had some success in locating the artifact we spoke about. An artifact that might have been used as a weapon in these murders.
Frock shifted in the wheelchair.
As you requested, I considered the matter further. I did a careful search of our accession database, both for single items and for items that could potentially have been broken apart and recombined.
He shook his head.
Unfortunately, I found nothing that even remotely resembled the imprint you showed us. There has never been anything like it in the collections.
Pendergast's expression betrayed nothing. Then he smiled.
Officially, we'd never admit this, but the case is, shall we say, a trying one.
He indicated his briefcase.
I am awash in false sightings, lab reports, interviews, but we're slow in finding a fit.
Frock smiled.
I believe, Mr. Pendergast, that what you do and what I do are not all that different. I've been in the same predicament myself, and no doubt His Eminence is acting as if nothing out of the ordinary is happening.
Pendergast nodded.
Wright is very eager that the exhibition go on as scheduled tomorrow night. Why?